Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Daniel Lacalle and Ira Harris. Daniel holds a PhD in economics and is chief economist at Tresis SV. He's been ranked in the top 20 most influential economists in the world, author of several books, including most recently Escape from the Central Bank Trap and Freedom or Equality. Ira's independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also a stint most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you very much for having us. Thank you. It's a great pleasure.
This is great. Thank you, Richard, as always.
Great. I thought we'd begin with a discussion on your macro view, Daniel, in terms of how you see the global economy and the financial markets.
The way that I would categorize the global economy is that it's living the basically just a situation in which we can say that it's almost like the hangover of the stimulus plans of 2020 and 2021. So after massive government spending plans, liquidity injections, the reopening of the economy after the pandemic, etc., it is literally like a hangover. So if we look at global growth estimates, they have been consistently revised downwards, and for logical reasons. It's simply not just that there's a Chinese slowdown, obviously, and that there is the impact of the Ukraine war, which are substantial, but also the fact that the expectations of fiscal multipliers of those stimulus plans of 2020-2021 were exceedingly optimistic. And I think that that is one of the big problems, because it leaves behind a massive trail of debt. No? So I would say that we have different speeds in this slowdown. It's very evident that the United States, despite its challenges, is doing better than the Eurozone, and certainly than Latin America. The Eurozone and Latin America lag behind in terms of recovery from the pandemic compared to Asia and the United States. And in the case of China, obviously, we have the COVID zero policy affecting growth, but we cannot forget other important factors about the Chinese economy, which is the burst of the real estate bubble and the tech crackdown. So those two things also hinder on growth prospects. So I would say that what we're looking at is a market that has gone from thinking that central banks would not dare to do what they said that they would do, to a market that has started to discount that central banks are going to do a lot more than they will and have said they will do. So I think that that is, to be as short and precise as possible, with the way that I would categorize the state of the global economy and markets.
Great, interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
I am so much in line with that. The global geopolitical situation is fraught with potholes. Nothing is as anybody thinks it is from week to week. Certainly day to day, it changes so quickly. I mean, we saw it last week, of course, when the Fed, 2 days before the meeting or 3 days, you know, basically what we would call in Chicago parlance, dropped a dime on the Wall Street Journal, Nick Timiraos, by letting it know that, well, what was previously off the table, 75 basis points, was now on the table and was a certainty. And, you know, I don't like when that takes place, by the way, and I know it happened with Hilsenrath, but I think journalists sell their souls, because now I will be skeptical that there's any independent thought, that he's totally dependent on the Fed picking up the phone and telling him, and then he gets out ahead. And I know it's good for his position, but I think it undermines the entire process, by the way. And I know that the Europeans always did that. I know that Trichet used that technique. And I believe right now, Philip Lane leaks to Reuters. I follow it pretty closely, and I see where it comes, and Reuters is always ahead of everybody else. So that seems to be the leak source. I really believe it's market disruptive. And again, it's one of the bad things from forward guidance, because when they guide you, then they want to set you up rather than let the market do what it, they don't respect markets enough to allow markets to work. That's the bottom line. So they're always trying to direct you and corral you. You know, they talk about finding their inner Volcker. Volcker could care less. You know, he was going to push his board to do what they believe. He certainly believed was best, and convince them why that was best. You know, I always think I was trading back in 79 on the Saturday Night Massacre, as they called it. I can remember exactly what I was doing, and I couldn't believe it. I thought it was a joke coming from Saturday Night Live, you know, and I had to, but it was real. The best Fed, see, this whole concept of forward guidance, I really believe that came from Michael Woodford, has been a gigantic mistake. If you surprise markets, markets will do, you know, what they need to do. Ben Bernanke's tempered reaction to the tempered tantrum will go down as one of the greatest mistakes ever, because he was on the right path and getting some type of normalization, but he cowered in the face of market. Let the market suffer the pain. It's one of the good things that's going on now, is that Powell, but I don't know that this is going to be, I don't know how much stomach they have for it. And especially, you know, everybody thinks they're going to go and get really aggressive, but we're coming into the November elections.
Yeah.
And the fallout from what the Fed laid out, Jerome Powell couldn't have been more precise a few months ago when he said, look, we can't do anything about the supply chains. We're helpless. The Fed has no tools to combat it. All we can do is affect demand. And the only way we can really affect demand is through wealth destruction. Well, the Fed finally found out what they're good at. But when people really start looking at their investments and the values of a lot of things that they hold near and dear, they're not going to be very happy when they realize this has been part of the Fed policy and therefore government policy, because certainly Biden has been lending his the Oval Office to support this. There's been no disruption between the two. So the wealth destruction that's going on is very real. Now, I felt that this should have been done 15, 16 months ago, and it'd been a far different place. The fact that all the major central banks kept QE going and supported the continued inflation of asset prices, which has bled over to everything, is should have been confronted long ago. When I say long ago, at least 15 to 18 months.
And what are your thoughts on that, Daniel, in terms of central bank policies to address inflation? Does it really make sense to do that through monetary policy, or is it more of a structural type of phenomenon? Where do you see the rate hikes going and also quantitative tightening?
Well, I think that I agree that forward guidance is, in general, a big mistake. Because what tends to happen with forward guidance is that market participants tend to believe that the central bank is not going to do what they say that they will do. So there's a perverse incentive to take extraordinary amounts of risk ahead of a Fed meeting in order to capture the upside of more dovish than expected policies. It's better if central banks simply go to a meeting and say, look, you know, this is where inflation is. Markets must have adjusted at least partially into those figures, and then make the right decision. And one of the reasons why the market has taken such elevated levels of risks, of risk in the last, especially 10 years, is because there was a very good trade in buying the dip into Fed meetings, because the possibility of getting an upswing based on more dovish policies was higher than the opposite. So what concerns me is what I repeatedly hear from, or at least get from, the messages of the Federal Reserve and also from the ECB, which is that markets are not to be trusted. The ECB wants to make adjustments so that the bond yields of Spain and Italy do not go higher than what they think is good. The Fed starts to move depending on what happens with asset prices. And ultimately, what we need to see is we need to see quantitative tightening, not just because of inflation, but because, as Ira has mentioned, because of massive asset inflation. It makes absolutely no sense to keep rates where they are with the level of inflation that the economy has and with the level of asset inflation that markets have. Is that going to solve supply chain challenges coming from Shanghai or cereal prices because of the Ukraine war? Certainly not. But we must also take into account that there is a very significant proportion of inflation that has a monetary component. In the case of Europe, it's very evident, no? The weakness of the euro plus the rise in core CPI significantly above historic levels, even historic levels of rising oil prices and rising gas prices, just to remember, now 2008 in June, when oil prices and natural gas prices reached a peak, the core inflation in the eurozone did not even get to the levels of 3.5%. So I think that central banks are tightening in a way that is not the ideal way. They should be tightening, as Ira said, with providing a surprise to markets and therefore letting market participants find the price that adjusts to reality, instead of what we're seeing right now. And if you see ETF inflows, that would scare you quite a bit, is actually that there continues to be a buy the dip mentality based on the idea that central banks are going to U-turn at some point.
You know, I think that, if I may, Daniel brings up a great point, because when we really get saddled with forward guidance, what we do is recreate Minsky on a cyclical basis, because you build in what Daniel talks about is the complacency. And it's interesting, I think it was probably about a year ago, maybe a little bit more, I believe it was Yi Geng from the People's Bank of China, who gave us a lecture about Minsky, that there was way too much complacency built into the markets. And he used Minsky's name. And I think that's where we've gotten to. And then it makes you, the reaction, maybe far more fiercer than we could ever imagine. So,
yeah. Yes. And to that point, we must remember that because of forward guidance, the message was contradictory. On the one hand, you had central banks saying this is the path of rate hikes that we're going to follow, while at the same time saying that inflationary pressures were transitory and that the global economy was much stronger. So if you as a market participant buy that message, you're thinking, okay, one second, inflation is transitory, growth is secure and robust, so they will not hike rates the way that they said. It's impossible, because it's a contradictory message, no? So what they are got, so for if anybody believed, or and I believe that a lot of people did, that message, what you end up doing is saying, let's go for the most cyclical, most aggressive part of the market and keep a little bit of cash in order to buy dips if they come along. And then you go 6 months after to the opposite side of that trade, in which it's, oh my gosh, central banks are not just going to do what they've said that they're going to do, but they're going to do it into a recession.
Yeah, into right. When it's great points, and you know, and the ones who really love it to me are the sales side of Wall Street and threatening. You know, they love it because it makes their life so easy. You know, you're buying the dips; they all look like geniuses. So you know what? And they're the ones who get to control the what you know. If you don't go to the Financial Repression Authority, you're saddled with watching, you know, the mainstays, the mainstream media for your financial news. And that's just all, you know, hoopla. The only time they bring out anybody bearish is when the market's already starting to correct and we're starting to see cracks in the edifice. But outside of that, it's, you know, if I'm a Wall Street salesperson, I've loved these years. There's nothing better. Forward guidance. And when it's adhered to, the greatest thing ever. It's the greatest sales tool I could ever have had.
Absolutely, I agree with that.
And Daniel, being in Europe, what are your thoughts on the European economy and the financial markets, particularly the debt markets, bond markets, and ECB interest rate policy? Any thoughts there, including the overnight lending, you know, sort of repo market as well there?
The Eurozone, to start with, was recovering from the pandemic at a much slower pace than the United States, both in terms of employment, in terms of wages, in terms of manufacturing, you name it, all of the economy in general. So that was in itself a big challenge, because on top of that, the European Union had launched this new program called the New Next Generation EU Funds. Okay, so as we saw, for example, with the Juncker plan, what governments were expecting that this next generation EU plus the recovery were going to deliver extraordinary levels of growth that had never happened in the Eurozone. No? So again, I come back to the point that there was a complete disproportionate level of faith on the idea that fiscal multipliers would be very strong. So with that, we have a much slower recovery, and with a much slower recovery, on top of that comes the Ukraine war and the challenges of Russian gas and the and trade with Russia, which is an important trading partner of the European Union. And the sanctions that have been implemented by the European Union have significant challenges, because to start with, obviously, shutting down commerce with Russia is something that probably was unavoidable, but on the eastern side, Russia continues to trade massively with China and massively with India and with other partners, and therefore the impact is relatively limited. No? So now what the Eurozone finds itself with is the monster challenge of natural gas supply, because there's no way in which the European Union is going to offset the volumes coming from Russia with any other source, certainly not with nuclear, because the Germans decided mistakenly to shut down the nuclear terminals, certainly not with solar and wind, and not with LNG either, because even with massive inflows of LNG coming from the United States, that is not enough. So to the slowdown, we have to add supply problems, supply problems in grain, supply problems in natural gas, etc. So that makes it much weaker, much weaker. On the European Central Bank side, the problem is that the European Central Bank is caught between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, if it normalizes and raises rates as expected and really tackles inflation, then the risk of a bond crisis like the one that we had in 2011 is pretty high. On the other hand, if it decides to focus on maintaining low yields for sovereign issuers, then the inflationary pressures are going to take the economy to a recession anyhow. Huh? So it's very difficult. I don't envy their position in any shape or form. But the reality is that despite everything, everybody's talking about normalization in the European Central Bank, but the European Central Bank balance sheet literally just printed another all-time high. So it's going to be very difficult for a very simple reason, is that throughout these last years, the European Central Bank was 100% of the net issuances of sovereign countries. So there is absolutely no way for us to discern at which level the secondary market would be happy to purchase Italian, Spanish, Greek government bonds, because the European Central Bank has disguised risk so severely that even a rise of yields to 3%, which is nothing, rocks the markets. No, and I think that that is the biggest problem, is that there is nobody in the European Central Bank that can really understand at which level demand from investors would settle at a certain yield to purchase sovereign bonds from the southern peripheral European countries.
Interesting. Your thoughts, Ira?
This is great, and I think Dan covered it so beautifully. You know, the three words of Lagarde's been under pressure, I think, since December, for sure, when we saw Jens Weidmann announce that he was leaving. But I think there was a lot of pressure, and you could see it upon her, because what was known as, of course, going back in history, but the Hanseatic Five, who were already rumbling because nobody has been more financially repressed than German savers over the last several years already. And they were ready, they were willing to live with it. Merkel had sold out the Bundesbank. The fact that she didn't fight for Weidmann to become chair of the president of the ECB back in when Draghi took the helm. And then it only got worse. And then Lagarde was certainly put in a place, not for her financial or economic acumen, but certainly for her political acumen, because this is now a political battle that's going to take place in Europe. I don't see a way around it. But the three words, of course, out of her mouth over the last 6 months have been optionality, flexibility, and now we have fragmentation. Which is interesting, because fragmentation, Lagarde's first press conference, she made the faux pas of faux pas by saying it's not the ECB's job to sustain yield spreads between sovereign debt. And we saw what happened then, and she backtracked as soon as she saw the results of it. So now they're committed to prevent any steep fragmentation in yields, especially between Germany and the Italians. But in order to do that, you are going to violate the Lisbon Accord and, of course, significantly, the capital key of the ECB. Now, you can argue whether it's a stocks or flow issue, as Draghi did and Lagarde has. But at some point, especially once you really get to the end of QE, and in fact, it's already been going on, the market is doing what the market is supposed to do, which is Daniel talks about, which is pushing these rates and finding out where is the real market? Mm. Because we know that's broken. Yeah, and the bond market is supposed to be a signaling mechanism. Now, I know the Europeans have talked about going to a broker-dealer system. Well, if you've got that plan in place, it's probably time to dust it off. And I know that when I originally read about going to a broker-dealer system like the U.S. has, that they were going to make sure that any broker-dealer was domiciled within the EU. So they were going to take London out of them. You could not be domiciled in London. So if you were going to be a player, you have to be a player within Europe and domiciled in Europe. So you got to be a Deutsche Bank, you have to be a Sachia, and you have to be one of the many large Italian UniCredit. But I always, you know, from an investment standpoint, my mouth keeps watering at the concept of what happens with Commerce Bank, because Commerce Bank is a giant who couldn't get out of its own way, and they've been trying to find a role for it. But if I was an institution like Goldman Sachs or something like that, and I wanted a domicile entity to be a part of the broker-dealer system, that's going to have to evolve, because the ECB is going to, you know, once they stop doing quantitative easing, they're going to have to find another way to direct the bond markets in Europe. And they're going to have to do it through a broker-dealer system to have a greater impact. But these are all things, you know, facing the future. But I really believe that this is going to wind up back in Karlsruhe at the German High Court, because there are going to be those in Germany, and it may come from Lindner himself, who's the Minister of Finance, who is a liberal or free Democrat in German terms, and who's going to push for this, because everything that Lagarde and Isabel Schnabel talked about are really in violation of Lisbon and, of course, the capital key. We can pretend and wink, but when that gets challenged, it's going to be interesting to see what happens in Europe.
That's a very good point. I think that right now, the ECB at least finds itself with a certain comfort that allows them to believe that they can almost implement any type of easing measure without having any tie, you know, from any of the countries. And the fact that in the last decision of the German Superior Court, they found a certain level of possibility of continuing with their policy without being challenged allows them to probably think that way. However, this is different, because this is not the same. It is not the same to help everyone at the same time than to disguise the fiscal challenges and the imbalances in the accounts of certain governments just to keep bond yields low. That makes no sense, because obviously what you're doing is not just in disguising risk of the government that continues to massively increase deficit and massively increase debt, but at the same time, you're penalizing the citizens of the countries that are doing things correctly. So instead of being a tool to support structural reforms, it becomes a tool to avoid them. The worst thing that the European Union can do is to that the Eurozone can do, sorry, is that the ECB starts to implement measures to curb bond yields without any level of conditionality. So the challenge that the ECB has is that they may agree that conditionality could be imposed on Spain, on Greece, or Portugal, but with Draghi, they're not willing to do that. So on top of the perverse incentive to disguise risk, you have now also an important difference, which is that it's not just taking action on those issuers that have increased significantly their imbalances, is that you might decide which one wins and which one loses according to political decisions, which is extraordinary, to be fairly honest. And I'm sure it's not going to happen. It cannot happen.
Interesting. Also, Daniel, you've recently written about food shortages that may happen from excessive intervention. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, we're talking about food shortages because of the Ukraine war, and everybody understands that Ukraine and Russia are very significant players in the grain market, and that the in some cases, particularly in some Middle Eastern and North African countries, they account for up to 80, 90% of the supply of grain. But what nobody talks about is that in the past 10 years, it's been almost impossible for farmers all throughout the European Union to develop their crops with a profit. Because between the CO2 costs, the newly added regulations, newly added taxes, etc., 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 the profitability of farming in numerous European countries, from Germany to Spain, has been completely demolished. We shouldn't be talking about any food shortage, because in 2018, 2003, we already had 18%, 20% of the global market disrupted. But there were alternatives. The problem now is that for the past 10 years, because of different legislations and different increases in taxation, etc., it's been virtually impossible for developed market farmers to grow their businesses profitably. So there is a second shortage, which is a regulated one.
And your thoughts on the food shortages situation, Ira?
Well, I think that they're real, and Daniel's to bring them to light is absolutely right. And I think, you know, going back to John Desjardins' great column back in right at the beginning of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, when he raised the issue about the fertilizer issue and the fact that European farmers will not, like everybody else, get the amount of potash that they need to put on their crops. And there's no, and the cost that they're going to have to bear to buy what they do buy is going to be enormous, and crops are going to be stunted. We're not seeing it right now. We're seeing some correction, of course, in the grain markets as weather patterns change. But to follow up on what Daniel says, and I think it's important, what I sit here and I watch and I go, it's amazing to me that we know we're on the brink of a global food crisis. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily for the developed nations, but the developing nations are certainly feeling it. And I sit here and wonder, how is it that the World Bank and IMF, along with the World Food Bank, aren't using IMF printed SDRs to buy up every stockpile of grain to ensure that the emerging markets are going to have enough food to prevent political crises from popping up all over different places? What, you know, everybody wants more SDRs, give them to them. You know, go to India and buy the rice surpluses that exist, because you're going to have to ensure that the emerging markets, because just like in the 70s, who suffered the most after the Russian wheat deal and sent grain prices significantly higher? It was the emerging markets, because they didn't have, and it's probably more acute now, because I believe that the rising dollar, and it's part of the things that fall down on Lagarde's shoulders, and certainly Kuroda's, the rising dollar is wreaking havoc in the emerging world, because they have to pay more to buy dollars to finance all of this activity. And the prices are going up beyond that. So they're getting hit in a much more difficult fashion. In the developed world, you know, we have the G7 meetings, we have G20 meetings. They sit on their hands instead of getting out in front of it. And had they really made moves to start purchasing massive amounts of grain to ensure the emerging markets, it would have lessened Putin's hold. Now, eventually the grain, of course, is fungible, and you're going to have to get that grain out of the Black Sea anyway. But you must secure grain supplies for the developing world. You must. Otherwise, you are going to be, as Daniel rightly points out, that's where we're going to be. And it's time to move, and it's time to do it with IMF created funds, SDRs. I know they're not totally IMF created, but something needs to done. And Daniel is right. And I know that there are others who are picking up his message in Europe by signaling the fear of a real food crisis looming.
Mm-hmm. And just related to that challenge is the concept of resource nationalism. What are your thoughts, Daniel, on that in terms of investment implications? Like, is there an approach to assess the risks of that from an investment perspective? Like, what types of companies to invest in, given the risk of resource nationalism? Like, for example, we've seen Argentina forbid the export of wheat, and other countries similarly as well. Your thoughts?
Yeah. Well, the first thing is obviously that every time that that something like this happens, people dust off the worst economic ideas possible. Mm? Yeah. And we're going back to autarky messages and protectionism and all the things that you've mentioned, which are very bad for investors because it's not very easy to find the opportunities. On the one hand, one would think, okay, if commodity prices are going to go up, then what we should do is invest in commodity producers. However, a vast majority of commodity producers in emerging markets in particular, but also globally, are semi-state owned or state owned, and they will be crushed in their margins by protectionism and governments forcing them not to increase prices alongside costs, as we saw, for example, in the early 2000s with Petrobras and with PetroChina. I think that the other problem is that is that many of the players that you would invest in are companies that are going to suffer, on the one hand, from the protectionism, not being able to export, but also the impact of weakening margins in general. No, so it is difficult. It's probably better to invest in it through the commodity space rather than through companies or stocks. You might have a situation that we have lived before, all of us, which is, sorry about this, which is that commodities actually start to go up because of the wrong nationalistic and protectionist measures. And the companies that should benefit from that scenario are actually suffering because margins are squeezed or intervened. No, my biggest concern is that it's going to go worse before it gets better. That is certainly the problem. And that on top of it, it's not easy to invest in it via currencies either, because if Argentina starts to prevent exports, what is going to happen to the Argentine peso? It will collapse, obviously, because it doesn't receive foreign reserves, no? And it's something that is interesting of this period, because what we're seeing is that in an environment of rising commodity prices, a lot of emerging economy currencies are actually weakening against the dollar because of things like that. No?
Very interesting, yeah. Your thoughts, Ira, on this?
Yeah, I think those are very important points. Yeah. And the only currencies, well, we'll take the ruble off the table for a minute, but I think that represents the ridiculousness of the sanctions that everybody applauded that were great, but I think Putin's sanctions have been better than the US sanctions in its totality. But any of the emerging market currencies that are holding against the dollar is only because they keep raising interest rates faster and more furious in order to stem any type of dollar decline. I'm sorry, any type of further dollar rally, because, you know, the one thing that is so vastly different from the 70s is there was debt, of course, at the core of the crisis in the 70s, but the amount of debt, especially dollar denominated debt, thanks to what the Fed has done, especially during the pandemic, has been enormous. And the ability to fund that debt, which, you know, as the global economy slows down, the ability to fund dollar denominated debt with rising interest rates and a rising dollar is, you're courting disaster for the global financial system. And I think it's one of the missing elements from every time I hear Fed policymakers speak. It's one of the reasons I miss Richard Clarida, because I think Clarida really was the force behind when the Fed was opened up the swap lines back in March of 2020 and realized how important they were. I think the international role of the dollar has been underplayed here. It's one of my concerns about Kuroda's policy and the weakening of the yen, because the weak yen allows the dollar to strengthen across the board, because it just does. And I would ask the question to Daniel. I mean, how high can the euro yen go until Germany and others really start to feel the pain of it? Because even if markets really open up, the Japanese are going to be well situated especially at the high-end products. Japanese cars will outperform German cars, I believe, by a lot, because the movement in the euro yen is 15 to 20% over the last 18 months. That's a significant move.
So, and think about it. Think about the squeeze for German producers.
Yeah.
On the one hand, the euro is weakening against the dollar, so the import of goods and services that you require to build cars, etc., is rising. And on the other hand, you're going to sell. You're becoming less competitive relative to the Japanese that are selling those same high-end products. So it's a very, very challenging situation, because how do you solve that? You cannot weaken the euro. You cannot weaken the euro against the yen and the dollar at the same time. You cannot. It's a very, very difficult situation. The ECB is always in touch with the Bank of Japan, and I'm sure that they are talking about how to manage the situation so that it doesn't get out of control. The Kuroda doesn't like a strong yen. The ECB doesn't like the euro to be so strong against the yen, but it doesn't like the euro to be stronger against the dollar. So it's a very difficult situation, because you're buying components, oil, gas, all of the things that you import. You're buying them in a weaker euro against the dollar, so your imports are rising. Think about this. The enormous trade surplus of the eurozone has switched back into a trade deficit. No? And on the other hand, your ability to compete with the Japanese is much more complicated. It's another clear episode or conclusion that currency wars never work. No?
Yeah. You know, if you let markets move and decide values, including bond values, central banks, you might be surprised what you might find. And instead of getting catastrophic movements that are forced upon you, the market is adjusting. You know, I like to go back to the concept of Darwin, where things are always changing, versus Georges Cuvier, who everything had to be a catastrophe. You know, the earth and things only changed by volcanic eruptions or earthquakes. We don't want the majors. We want things to be shifting on a constant daily basis, because then they work better rather than having to go to major disruptions.
Mm-hmm.
Just a final question. Given all these risks, I mean, financial risk, operational risk, geopolitical risk, what are the investment implications? How do investors position themselves generically? Daniel?
Well, the way that we have positioned ourselves, and obviously we believe that the biggest risk is stagflation, is to have a portfolio that has some defense. So we're strongly positioned positive on the dollar. Also, we maintain some gold and some silver. And what we have done is to avoid sovereign bonds, because I don't think that there is value in sovereign bonds. And we're taking positions in companies with strong cash flow generation and in equities with strong cash flow generations that are able to maintain their margins, that are not under the pressure of government. So basically, we have moved our portfolio to developed economies, to the dollar, and to gold and silver.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
I'm very much in line with that, and I'm trying to find companies that have very low levels of debt, because debt is again as rates are starting to rise, and it's kind of laughable. I mean, everybody gets, oh, the ECB is going to raise rates. Well, right now they're at negative 50 basis points
exactly
on the interest on reserves. Okay, they're going to raise 50. Okay, they're going to zero. You know what? If you're not going to 4 or 5% within the next 3 months, you may get there, but there is a movement and there's ways to deal with it. But regardless, I think when you look to see at the investment grade and non-investment grade debt that's taking place, I agree with everything Daniel said. I think that's right. And you want to find high quality companies. You know, I'm looking at ones that are positioned, and especially if you see, if the EU goes from, interestingly, what Wolfgang Schäuble had talked about when they were talking about giving loans out to ease countries through the pandemic, and he said, giving loans is like giving them stones, whereas if you actually give them grants and fiscal stimulus, which coming from Schäuble, I thought was interesting, you're giving them bread rather than stones. So I would look for companies, especially in Europe, that may benefit from some type of massive fiscal stimulus across Europe, because as the ECB is forced to step back, it's going to have to come from fiscal policy. So I'm looking at companies like ABB. Mm-hmm. As I said, Commerzbank is really attractive to me, cautiously. But I look for things like that. I think the European banking system has been so under, rightfully so, by the way, so under respected for quite a while. But if they can get some fiscal stimulus going, I think that's what it's going to take in Europe. There will be no return to the Schwarz now in Germany. I think Lindner is worth watching here. There's just so much to pay attention to. And it'll be interesting to see how high the Fed goes. And I think that Daniel's call on silver and gold are right, because I don't think we're going to get to real positive yields on the short term. And that's where central banks really have an impact. If they could get to real yields, so that would take a Fed funds rate probably today of 6% to have a genuine real yield relative to core prices. Are they going to get there? Not a chance in the world. There is no inner Volcker. And as I wrote, I think it was the last blog that I wrote, it's been about a month, but even Powell, even Volcker couldn't find his inner Volcker in a world so laden with debt. You know, when Volcker went on that path, he could do it because probably the debt to GDP level was around 40%, I believe. And exactly. Personal debt was not, credit cards weren't as expensive. And we see credit card exploding. So there is a limit to how far Powell's going to go here. Because had Volcker done what he did in a world similar laden with debt, we would have been in the depression. Forget about a severe recession. You would have had a massive liquidation of assets across the board. So we're in a different world. So how high that they can go, I don't believe they'll ever get to real yields unless you got a collapse in prices. And that would be not a good thing. So I think it would protect gold and silver anyway, because gold and silver, as even John Authors wrote and finally found his way to seeing, gold and silver do not represent really inflation. They represent central bank credibility. And the greatest deficit in the world right now is central bank credibility. And it's not getting any better in the short term. Powell, I'll give him credit, is fighting for it, but he's really late. And there is, again, I'll stress it, there is no inner Volcker. There can't be an inner Volcker in a world so laden with debt.
Great, fascinating discussion. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Daniel?
Oh, I think it's pretty easy to find me. You can find me on my website. It's dlacalle.com, which is in Spanish and English. You can find me on Twitter at dlacalle_IIIA. You can find me. I don't think it's very, very difficult to find me. So really looking forward to continue the discussion with anyone who follows.
Yes, exactly. And Ira?
You know, these podcasts are great for me. I get to discuss things with you, Richard, and of course, Daniel and others. So I think these are worth a lot. I go back and listen to them all the time to try to bring out some things. And you know, the ones we've done with Louis Gavet, and I'll say this, that Louis had a really good point about the euro yen. And he brought up the point that he thought that the yen was being driven lower because China was trying to drive the Europeans out of China. Now that's a theoretical basis, but I think it's an interesting topic. And it's through these things that we get to have these discussions. So I love it. And Daniel's right. He's very easy to find if you want to find him. If he's trying to hide, he's doing a very poor job. So, but through Notes from Underground, which when my vision, my eyes are really bad, I really can't sit down and write because I really can't see the keyboard well enough. So hopefully I'm going to get this corrected very soon. But through these, especially the financial repression authorities, I think are really great ways for people to learn and find ways to invest. And it had warned against what was coming early here. Now, how we come out of this, I don't know yet, but if you stay in high quality companies with low debt and quality dividends that have been secure, I think you can ride this out.
Great. Thank you, Daniel and Ira. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Thank you very much. What a great pleasure. Always.
Yeah, this was a great pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only, and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.